Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Wednesday. It's February 5th. 36 degrees currently here in Old Town Park City. We've got 41 degrees in the Heber Valley. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. As we take a look at your forecast for today, you probably noticed we've got those clouds really filling in back out there across the area. Temperatures, as you mentioned, starting off in the 30s and 40s, so above freezing as we've got a little moisture working its way in ahead of a cold front that's going to be moving on through. So that cold front is going to bring us a chance of some rain and snow showers during the first half of the day, ending as a few snow showers even down towards the Heber Valley as we get towards this afternoon. But it should not amount to too much, maybe a couple of inches of snow for the high Park City mountains. And then as you get towards the valley areas, you may see a little bit of a trace out there. But overall, mostly just a liquid event coming through this morning. That cold front will bring those gusty winds ahead of it out of the south, but it will bring the wind out of the west and northwest behind the front, and that will allow for some dropping temperatures out there. So we'll see our temperatures dropping through the 40s as we go into the afternoon and into the 30s. And as we go into the rest of tonight, we'll see those overnight lows dropping back down into the 20s across the region. So some cold air will begin to work its way in as we dry things out tonight. The winds will start to calm down just a little bit. But as we go into your Thursday, look for more clouds than sunshine to develop once again across the area. Temperatures will likely be looking at high temperatures back into the low to mid 40s for highs around Park City and the mid to upper 40s there in the Heber Valley. Most of the day on your Thursday should be dry, but by late Thursday afternoon and Thursday evening, we could start to see a couple of isolated snow flurries developing, but overall should not amount to much. Now, Thursday night heading into Friday, that's when we're going to see our next storm system rolling in. That will bring a little more significant moisture to the area. So we're talking about looking at snow developing, and it will be likely as to go throughout the day in Park City, and that could add up to a couple of inches of snow likely developing there around the Park City area. And in the Heber Valley, we're looking at some rain and snow showers mixed together developing. And by the time we get towards the Friday afternoon, Friday evening time frame, even there we'll see that transition over to all snow, and we could pick up an inch or two of snow even down towards the Heber Valley, as high temperatures will be struggling to reach the 40 degree mark as we go into your Friday. Now, Friday night into Saturday, we start to dry things out heading into the weekend. Partly cloudy skies, just a slight chance of a few snow showers early Saturday. The bigger story will be the big chill that will be building back into the area. We're talking about overnight lows as we get into your Saturday morning, down into the teens, highs on your Saturday afternoon, not getting out of the mid-20s in Park City, and not getting above freezing in the Heber Valley. And by the time we get towards your Sunday morning, get ready for winter's chill to return as overnight lows will drop down into the single digits. And we're looking at high temperatures only in the upper 20s. And that pattern looks to stick around right into the beginning of next week. So we've got some big time winter-like temperatures returning and a chance of some snow on Friday. But between now and then, just a few rain and snow showers today as temperatures will start to cool down.
Okay, well, you've got our inch here and an inch there. We need 6 to 8 inches to get our Nordic trails back open.
Yes,
when's that going to happen?
That's a great question. We're going to have a slight chance of doing that by Friday night into Saturday, but the better chance probably looks to be a more active pattern by the time we get towards Valentine's Day. Fingers crossed. That's the way it's looking now.
Okay, thanks, Edward.
Thank you.
And taking a look in the backcountry from the Utah Avalanche Center, we've got Drew. Good morning, Drew.
Leslie, the most significant avalanche reported was in your backyard yesterday, just what looks to be east of Empire Pass. I'm sure there's a local name for it, but it broke out 2 to 3 feet deep, maybe 400 feet wide. I've heard it called Disease Bowl. I'm sure there's a few different local names to it, but it's heavily wind-loaded. Shoulder, I mean, wind has certainly been the name of the game, but this broke almost to near the ground in old, weak, faceted snow. Just the winds have been, again, relentless, merciless, and they continue to be strong from the southwest. Had this little weak disturbance. We still have considerable danger for all steep, wind-drifted slopes. That'll be primarily upper elevation north through east. I mean, it's really a grab bag of stuff going on. I mean, we've had, obviously, record warm temperatures. Wet avalanches are going to be on the radar. There are some significant wet avalanches down in the Provo Area Mountains yesterday in the mid and low elevations that were just gouging to near the ground in wet basal faceted grains. There's a lot of uncertainty, and when I have a lot of questions, I step back and just sort of let things play out and see what's going on. But again, air is a considerable danger for wind-drifted slopes. Also, air is a considerable for some wet avalanches across the range as well. I know temperatures are cooling a bit, but it's just what I'd call wolf in sheep's clothing. It's just very superficial in terms of taking care of the wet avalanches. I think the cold front this weekend should probably lock things up pretty good, but we'll just play it one day at a time.
Okay, so this avalanche that you mentioned here, kind of on the behind the Deer Valley Mountain Resort, naturally triggered. So, I mean, would blasting from another area kind of set it off? Or
No. I mean, I'm glad you're looking at the photo right there, because it's a meaty piece of snow that ran naturally. It was so much excessive wind loading, just more and more and more snow being deposited on that leeward side. It's just been nonstop, and so it just too much was too much, and it just released naturally.
Okay, be careful out there, Drew.
Thanks so much, Leslie. See ya.
Stay tuned. Coming up, we'll be checking in with Summit County Community Development Director Peter Barnes. Later on, Park City Manager Matt Dye is previewing this week's City Council meeting. And finally, I'll be talking with University of Utah head Alpine ski coach J.J. Johnson with details about this week's Utah Alpine Invitational happening at the Utah Olympic Park. Then stay tuned for The Mountain Life. Today's guests include Dr. Sunita Saw, who radically redefines our idea of defiance from a misunderstood negative trait into a crucial positive force for personal wellness. Then nutritionist Kara Sheary of Lifestyle Medicine and Wellness Center at Intermountain Park City Hospital explores the concept of food as medicine. Stay tuned. Well, 47 Summit County residents may decide whether to form a new town this fall. West Hills, which has attracted widespread opposition around Camas, has its supporters as well. And after 2 years of heated public debate, West Hill appears to have met the requirements for a vote. Just the 47 registered voters within its boundaries would have a say. 11 registered voters who County Clerk E. First says her office has verified signed the petition to put the incorporation on November's ballot, meeting that 10% voter threshold. Well, on the phone now with an update from the Summit County Planning Office, I have Community Development Director Peter Barnes. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you on this wet and blustery day?
Doing great, thank you. So let's start with West Hills. If successful, then what? Basically, Summit County, it's hands off?
To all intents and purposes, it's pretty much hands off right now and has been for a while. There seems to be not quite a complete misunderstanding, but there's the community at large seems to think that this is very much a county-involved process, but really this is a portion of the state municipal code. It's not within my purview as the Community Development Director for Summit County. We do get to comment. We do actually have an interest, obviously. The county does provide services to the area, and currently their feasibility study assumes we will continue to provide some level of service to the town. So whilst we have a direct involvement in the outcome, we don't actually get to influence it in any direct way. I was invited to comment on the draft feasibility study that was presented to us in November of last year. And that raised some doubts and queries on my part, together with some interest from our Housing and Economic Development Director Jeff Jones and Matt Levitt, our Chief Financial Officer. But in between that draft and then the final report being issued, there were some changes made to the pro forma by the developer, which seemed to apparently take it from a position of failure to a position of success, based on assumptions made by the developer. And whilst that may raise a degree of skepticism, there's not a lot we can do about it right now. We're going to wait and see what the results of the election is going to be.
Okay, I can't bring your levels up anymore on my side. So if you could do it on your phone, just...
Is that better?
That's a lot better. Thank you.
Okay. The wet weather seems to be impacting our internet, so that's going to be a fun exercise.
Yeah. All right. Well, so does this mean, I mean, as an incorporated town, that West Hills would be required to have their own water and sewer service, as well as a police force and a city council and all that goes along with being a municipality?
Well, on its basis level, yes, but those services can be contracted. Fire, police, you know, first responders, etc., could be contracted to the outside. Waste collection is currently provided by county and county services, so that could be contracted from the county. The critical one to me, just from my own experience of development, is the proposal to build a town, which includes, for example, 67,000 square feet of commercial development in an area that has no current water infrastructure or wastewater infrastructure. So the expense of creating that kind of capital improvement, there's no real indication as to how that would be done in the feasibility study. There's just an assumption it would be done by the individual property owners. If you imagine the idea of well and septic systems, that's not really going to work for the larger scale commercial project. Might work for a larger home on a large lot, but not for multifamily housing and not for commercial lots. So how that problem is going to be resolved, we're in the dark about that.
Yeah, right. But again, who has the say-so about, you know, whether or not a sewer water treatment is required, or they just do it with septic tanks? I mean,
it's within the town. The town has the capability of creating its own rules. Currently, it's in the Summit County Sewer Improvement District, the Eastern Summit County Sewer District. We have a district, but we don't have any infrastructure. The health department, you know, governs many of these aspects per state rules. So a system that would be created would probably be overseen by the state, but the sponsoring political body for any kind of system would be the town itself, I'm quite sure.
So at some point, does the county get to prepare some sort of rebuttal when voters actually get to go out and vote on this?
Not that I'm aware of. I think we're hands off, and it's in the hands of the voters.
Okay.
I like to think that the voters would be fully educated as to the potential risks and rewards, and we're happy to explain our position to anyone who would like to ask.
All right, moving on to the Eastern Summit County Planning Commission, two public hearings about preliminary subdivisions, one in Peoa, one in Hennifer. They're small. They're 3- and 4-lot subdivisions. So maybe explain, what are preliminary subdivisions, and are these a result of a new state law?
They are. Well spotted. They're actually relatively simple in the subdivision world, but if you remember rightly, last year the state changed the law that essentially was supposed to streamline the process. In terms of the preliminary subdivision, this is the one and only opportunity for the Planning Commission to lay their cards on the table, raise their objections, ask questions. It's the one and only public hearing that's possible for the subdivision. And at the end of the preliminary subdivision process, the hearing, the recommendation by the Planning Commission, all the technical criteria that would be required to satisfy the final subdivision need to be part of the conditions of that approval. And then that final subdivision, all the applicant is required to do is tick the boxes, meet the service provider requirements. It would then go to the county manager for a final approval.
So it sounds like it's just a lot easier now for property owners to subdivide their property.
That was the theory. One of the things it has actually done, for the small property owner, the idea previously where we'd do potential sketch plan approvals, where we would give initial input and advice, point people in the right direction with regard to solving technical problems. Now, because the service providers, engineering department, sewer, water, fire district, etc., get one shot at it, then they're going to ask for all the technical information to be provided early in the process. So for a small project, you're committing in advance to creating a set of technical drawings, which previously you may not have had to do. So there are going to be some winners and some losers in this new process. The winners would probably be the larger projects, the larger developers, where that commitment's already in place. The small subdivision separating a lot from, you know, for family purposes might be a bit more complicated than previously anticipated.
So maybe what is a subdivision anyway? I mean, do you get additional density through subdivision, or is it just a way to sell a portion of your land without selling the whole lot that you started with?
Essentially, yes. Imagine you have one lot and you want to end up with two lots. Clearly that's a subdivision, self-explanatory. Whether you're allowed to do it or not depends on the underlying zoning of the property. If you have property in the AG10, as we call it on the east side, the clue's in the name, 10 acres would be the minimum required In terms of land area, if you want to do a four-lot subdivision, you would have to start with at least 40 acres of land to create four lots in the AG 10 zone. So in many of these zoning districts, we have properties that are larger than the underlying base zoning, and therefore people are allowed to come in and ask for a rezone to subdivide their property so it would still meet the zoning requirements of the county.
So what are your biggest concerns about this new process, or do you, is it just made it a lot easier for the planning department?
It's harder for us. It's faster work. It puts time limits on what we're allowed to review. How, you know, we basically get a 15-day turnaround period at this preliminary subdivision period. Once we get a complete application, we've deemed it complete, we actually reach out. We manage the project. We reach out to all the service providers, health department, fire department, engineering department, etc., collect all that information, provide it to the applicant. And we have to do that within a very limited time frame. It's not so difficult collecting that information on the small lot. It puts the technical requirement, pushes it back onto the applicant. For larger projects, obviously, there perhaps might be a significant number of technical questions involved, and we have to get them all done within that same limited time frame.
Wow. And you said final approval rests with the county manager?
County manager. Council no longer get to look in on the subdivision process.
Wow. Okay. Stay tuned.
Stay tuned. It's going to be an exciting time. This is a learning exercise for all of us. These are the first two under the new process. So
yeah,
we're going to be feeling our way through it.
And I guess it's just like, how do you possibly get that work done? I mean, do people start working, you know, 80-hour work weeks?
You mean take a cut in hours? No, I don't see how that's possible. Mm-hmm. Yes. Essentially, it just means harder and faster and more efficient work. And there's nothing wrong with making government more efficient where we can. What we don't want to do is take unnecessary risks. So we will just keep working as hard and as efficiently as we possibly can.
All right. Blue Sky will also be back at the Eastern's Side Planning Commission for their subdivision approval. What are they asking here for again?
Well, that's an interesting one, too, following up from the last question. Previously, Blue Sky were at the East Side Planning Commission looking for a rezone and subdivision. They were looking for an increase in lots over and above what they would be allowed under their base zoning, together with some amenities, shared amenities with the Blue Sky Lodge project. There was some resistance from the Planning Commission, or rather skepticism and queries, nothing dramatic, but there has been something of a public outcry. Blue Sky have since retired, created a new plan, and are now returning with a base subdivision, or rather a base density with what we do allow on the east side is a cluster bonus subdivision that's under the existing zoning regulations. There is no rezone being requested in this phase. So instead of, I think it was 72 lots before, it's now a 30-lot subdivision and no new amenities. So that was actually just going to be processed under existing zoning, no new zoning. So it's not as complicated whether it's successful or not, whether it's what we want to see or not, it's a separate question, but they're allowed to apply for this. And if it meets all the criteria, then it will be approved eventually.
All right. Looking at the Canyons parking garage, sounds like they are biting at the bit here, ready to get going.
The lack of snow, which is disappointing to many skiers, is actually encouraging an exciting group of people to start construction as soon as possible. So the first part of the construction festival, beginning as soon as the snow makes it possible, would probably be the parking garage and the slopeside housing. Both of those projects, the phase one of the parking garage, and the slopeside housing, they're just wrapping up their paperwork necessary, posting the appropriate bonds so they can start grubbing the site, moving machinery onto the site, start digging holes in the ground. So that'll be the first thing that people see. But the parking garage phase two, they're already raising queries as to whether or not they should submit their building permits imminently for the phase two of the parking garage. So prior to starting work on phase one, we will be receiving the construction documents for the phase two on the parking garage. So excitement is mounting.
Yeah, we've got a ski season, though, that lasts through mid-April. Is any potential construction going to mess that up?
That's the That's the big question. The whole construction mitigation plans have to address all of those issues. No, we don't allow large construction machines to compete with people queuing for a ski lift. That's not going to happen. The canyons themselves have control over a lot of this exercise. Where projects can be isolated, yes, definitely so. But typically we don't build during construction season. So if there's prep work that can be done, that overlaps without interfering with the existing operations of the ski area, that might be able to move ahead sooner rather than later. But it's nearly always weather dependent, the length of the ski season. We're not going to interfere with, you know, the primary operating business of the ski area. It's raising debt or is putting skiers on mountains. We're not going to interfere with that with a dangerous construction project.
All right. Now, Slopeside Housing, they're not building any more affordable housing, right? Is this, what, market rate housing?
It's essentially market rate. It's workforce. So the people who occupy the housing will be employed within the canyons, subject to the same deed restrictions, but it doesn't qualify under the affordable housing criteria. This was the project that was approved last year, or towards the end of last year, as the phase two. So this was always anticipated. But this is the employee housing portion above the affordable housing rate.
Okay. And a number of units that are proposed?
Oh, you've caught me out.
Okay.
I should be able to tell you that off the top of my head. I'm going to go with a 130 type number, but I would have to go back and pull that number exactly. So apologies for that, Leslie. You caught me out.
I can find it. All right. The outlets are looking to come back to the Basin Planning Commission for a work session on their proposed rezone. So when's that happening?
So next week, Tuesday, February the 11th, is the tentative date. We met with them. We actually have two newly appointed planning commissioners, Spencer Young and Tim Jeffrey, came out of the interviews that the council had last week. And we have a relatively recent appointment to the planning commission, and Megan Recker, who have not seen the earlier iterations of this project. So whilst the outlet developers and architects have been working on refining some of their prior ideas and thoughts, we thought it would be a good idea to bring it back soon so we can do a recap of the existing project and show what's on offer. It is actually a proposal for a neighborhood, you know, what mixed use zone, an NMU zone. There will be CUP projects involved, there'll be master plans involved. But in terms of gross figures, if you want to open everyone's eyes really wide on a wet Wednesday, 57,000 net square feet of new commercial, 432 units currently proposed new residential. What they are proposing to do in the big picture is the northern part of the outlet mall, or the southern part of the outlet mall, the upper level of the outlet mall commercial. That commercial will predominantly go away, be replaced by essentially a larger residential portion of the project to create a mixed-use internal development, and then the existing commercial will be redeveloped to make that more viable. It's a very interesting project. It's been in front of the Planning Commission a number of times. The earlier iterations, I'd say, developed a level of intrigue and interest at the Planning Commission, but we're now going back with some of the details. How on earth does this work? How will it fit within the neighborhood? That's what the reintroduction is next Tuesday.
Okay. And finally, I just wanted to ask you, any action from Cedar Crest? I mean, and I guess, you know, we like to ask every month, just at some point, does the application with Summit County expire, or...?
There is potential for that. It's a fairly easy thing to overcome. At the nine-month mark, which is imminent, we will send them a letter that's saying we've heard nothing, we've got nothing, we're going to cancel this application unless something happens, and no doubt we will be contacted and they would like to have a meeting. So it keeps that application ticking over. As recently as last week, I did get a casual comment from a representative of that group that they do intend to come back and do intend to come back imminently. So I'm actually looking forward to that, because the idea of revealing to KPCW listeners that I'm completely in the dark is not a satisfactory one for me. So we will be pushing one way or another on this project.
Okay, so we haven't heard about a formal annexation petition then with Colville at this point.
No, we are aware of the fact that conversations have been taking place with Colville. And the triggers for that may be, again, this takes us back full circle to the West Hills, the creation of an independent infrastructure requirement for wastewater and water supply, or whether through an annexation process they can attach themselves to Colville and develop through there. That's probably the trigger. I'm not heavily involved in that, but that's probably what caused the conversation. So that formula is just probably being run backwards and forwards between the parties.
Okay, got to leave it there. Peter, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Leslie. Bye now.
Peter Barnes, again, is the Summit County Community Development Director. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. The Park City Council meets in work session Thursday starting at about 4:50, and in the studio with a preview, City Manager Matt Dias. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you?
Great, thank you. So during work session, Council will hear this request from the organizers of Song Summit. Sounds like they want to move the event again this year to City Park. The staff reports notes that there are a number of challenging logistical conflicts, the first one being that this event is huge, and it's proposed for a local time period, maybe, you know, like this is when we're supposed to do nothing. So can that even be overcome?
Well, I think it, ooh, that's loud, excuse me. I think it can be overcome. Just to take a step back, you know, more or less a local event that's grown in size over the years and has become extremely popular. And what they're requesting is a level 5 event. We have sort of thresholds for events in our community based upon size, scopes, and impact. And because they are requesting this year, we would need sort of the mayor and council to give us the head nod to begin working on something of this magnitude. So there's a couple different options in here. This isn't an event approval or anything like that. This is more allowing the Song Summit to have a discussion with the mayor and council about what they're contemplating and what's occurring at the other venues in our community, what they're thinking for venues within the city, and get some sense of a read from the mayor and council about whether this is something they want to explore this year or maybe years moving forward. There are some alternatives in here. Like one is if it's really desirable but the impacts are too pervasive in the short term, they could give us the head nod to engage in a level 5 event discussion looking ahead and moving forward. But as you noted, there are some considerable impacts with summer camps and other things in terms of using City Park and the fields, and we want to get ahead of it with the mayor and council.
Again, we've got recreation calendars to use City Park softball field. We've got an outdoor volleyball tournament. We've got day camp. I mean, it feels like we're trying to put a square peg into a round hole. So, I mean, at this point, why not just say we can't do it this year?
Well, administratively, we really couldn't do that. This is a decision for the mayor and council. Mm-hmm. That's not an administrative decision that we can just make summarily, particularly if someone's interested in a level 5 threshold event. That would require a big special event contract. So we're getting them early, getting a pre-screening. We also know that this is a very heavily attended locals event. It's something that a lot of our locals look forward to. And so, again, we're just sort of passing through the application, the pre-application, if you will, to the mayor and council.
So it could stay at the Canyons Village. That's the plan if the council doesn't move forward with this. Or is there a conflict there?
No, I don't actually know. As you know, not being the event organizer, I'm not actually sure. I'm not aware that there's any problem at the Canyons, at least that I'm aware of. But that'd be a great question for them.
And as part of the proposal, they want to use the Jim Sanning Auditorium for some workshops. Could they use Library Field for their concerts and just stay out of City Park?
I don't know. I think that's something that we could contemplate, and we'd have to look at the land use regulations and see if there's any prohibitions. I know that from time to time we will use the patio at the library. I mean, we just had the Sundance Film Festival, which is also a level 5 special event, where we are able to convert some of our municipal facilities temporarily to support those types of endeavors. I can't think of a time that we have fully used the library field other than a real civic event. That's nothing comes to mind, but perhaps.
And you mentioned these 4,000 person concerts are planned, two of them. How would that compare with the numbers that we see on a 4th of July?
Well, let's see. I think to roll the clock way back, probably 5 or 6 years ago, we did hold some concerts, I believe, working with the Park City Institute on the City Park field. We actually stand up a small bandstand and a stage, And it's obviously a beautiful place to do it. I mean, sort of in the heart of town, on the basin floor, in City Park, looking at the mountains. However, it's not necessarily a purpose-built area, so it doesn't come embedded with some of the, bathrooms and electric, and so there's some generators, and, you know, it's hard to stand up a venue from scratch, and so that was a challenge, although I'm still, moving around this community, and people will sometimes, like, hearken back to those concerts. It was a very nostalgic moment for them. This is sort of the balancing act of mitigating impacts, wanting to create community. It's a great discussion for the mayor and council to have before we make any decisions or work on this more administratively.
Okay. During the regular meeting, council will get an update on the remediation happening or happened at the Goder property. This is, again, just north of 248. The cleanup is complete at a cost of just over $3 million. So, now what?
Well, hat tip here first. I think before I get to the now what, I want a hat tip here. For years, road projects, sidewalks, tunnels, different types of public infrastructure projects, this had been sort of a temporary tipping spot for Park City, where we were storing soil that was in our soil district. And so for a number of years, we've been working with environmental agencies, and we are completing this project, to your point. So after a long time, we removed 62,000 tons. We're removed from the site, and that's thousands of truck trips and ongoing remediation and watching, the systems and spraying down truck tires and really trying to make sure that we fully complied with all the environmental regulations. So hat tip to the internal team at the city that accomplished this after years and years. And then hat tip to those that created great relationships with our regulators. I think we've never probably had a stronger relationship with our environmental regulators now as a result. And so, the site basically is now ready for any type of redevelopment or repurposing that the community would desire. And so that could even mean commercial or residential or public infrastructure. It could also remain in repose. It could be just a natural environment moving forward.
I thought we were looking at a park and ride for that location.
That's been contemplated for a long time. We conventionally use the name Gordo, but there's several different parcels in there. There would need to be a subdivision process, but that's been long contemplated as a very viable location on the entry corridor to siphon off some vehicles moving in and out of town. I think that's a discussion that the mayor and council will be having moving forward.
All right. Council will also be considering amendments to the Bonanza Flat Conservation Area Management Plan to possibly include paid parking. And the news here is that city residents, those paying off the bond, would actually get free parking. How would you possibly manage that?
Well, I think it's actually, logistically, it's a pretty easy thing to do. And we currently have different types of permit parking programs throughout our downtown infrastructure in the parking garages and in Old Town generally, where vehicles don't even have a permit on their car. So you register your license plate, and we use a license plate reader technology. It's been around for decades. So it's actually, logistically, it's not complicated. But we'd have some type of a system where probably very similar to our residential permit parking program, where people would have to file for their permit, register their license plate, and they would be in our system as a resident, and they'd be able to park there.
Yeah. What are we talking about? Do we have numbers in terms of how much it would cost? Or? Would it be hourly? Would it be flat fee?
I think those are fine questions, and we're just a little early in the process. To be fair, I think we hope it never came to this. I think, this is kind of an adaptive management strategy. As the property gets used more and more, we've had some safety issues with people parking on shoulders and running across the street and double parking. Believe it or not, just parking people in so people would return from a hike or a bike ride or a picnic, and they'd be locked up there for an hour or two because someone parked incorrectly. And then in other instances, because of poor parking choices, we've had emergency vehicles actually have difficulty getting through and in and out. So to be fair, we hope it never came to this. This is kind of an evolution of things. In terms of the specific about cost and time and duration, I think that's all TBD after we get the mayor and council to make a determination that, we've risen to this point, the concerns are great enough, we need to start managing this resource in a more proactive way than we have been currently.
All right. Also contemplated as part of this would be enhancing the transit to trails program. Why can't we just get UDOT to open up Twisted Branch, or the city to open up Twisted Branch?
I don't think that solves the issue. I think we're always going to want a public transit amenity or access to this point in order to reduce the impacts on the land. I believe that's actually in some of the conservation easement language and in the adaptive management plan, that public transit can siphon off a significant percentage of the day-to-day drive traffic and impacts to this area. So irrespective of what road, I think we're firmly committed, and we've had a lot of success working with the Summit Land Conservancy. The Central Wasatch Commission has supported the level of transit service financially. So there's a good deal of cooperation to reduce our impacts. And I think transit will continue to be a really important component of that.
Okay. And when you talk about enhancing, what would we be looking at?
I think, to be fair, it's a pretty significant enhancement. I want to recall it's a 20 or 30 minute regular service running 6 months a year or more. But again, getting a little bit ahead of myself, these are all policy decisions that the mayor and council would make for us, and we would come back with a fairly defined and scripted plan. We want to make sure that they want that level of investment, that they also agree that the property should be managed differently.
Okay. Using a contractor like we're doing now, is that, or would it be actually a new bus route?
That's actually a very fine question for the mayor and council, which they'll get to decide. I think we have both options on the table in the staff report. I believe the team thinks that we can actually amend one of the existing routes. Don't quote me on this. I think it's the purple, which goes all the way up to the Empire Lodge, but where they could kind of extend the purple and add some buses to the purple line. Or conversely, to your point, we can continue to try to source the service from the private sector. However, I think our team thinks they'd like to give it a try and keep it on the purple line and expand the level of service there.
All right. Treasure Hill Conservation Easement. Sounds like it's finally going to happen on Thursday. You know, reading in the packet there, it noted some changes made by Summit Land Conservancy about if there would be a new property owner. Talk to me about that. I mean, can the city sell this after residents voted to buy it?
I would be shocked if something like that could actually occur. Mm-hmm. Given, to your point, how much work, time, and effort, and sort of the spirit of the purchase, I think technically it's probably possible you'd go through some sort of a defeasement process. But there'd be no reason to really have that conversation. I cannot imagine a scenario where the municipality would engage in a sale of this asset after running a public bond and going through a voter process and then making the acquisition. So I don't want that to be a soundbite on the story that you run. I think they're just, you know, the Land Conservancy is naturally thinking, what happens in 20, 40, 60, 70 years when we're all gone, and just trying to lock everything in and identify any type of externality at all. And to be fair, we're working together on that. And I think we have a common goal. And so that was something additional that was added. But I want to be clear, I cannot imagine a scenario where something like that occurred.
All right, dotting the I's, crossing the T's.
Thank you.
Yeah, okay. Also, some concerns were expressed recently in a letter to the editor about possible rental housing being built next to Park City Heights on that Clark's Ranch parcel. Is that still the plan? And where are we with that development?
Yeah, thank you. I think, you know, since we made the Clark Ranch acquisition, which was a property acquisition sort of on both sides of Highway 40, so on the east and west side, or the sort of inland side of Highway 40 next to Park City Heights, and the far side out on Richardson Flat, we've contemplated, I think, up to 10 acres for some type of a community housing redevelopment. And so for the last year and a half, we've been engaged heartily in a lot of pre-development activities. And we currently are negotiating with Alexander Company. We had them in about 2 or 3 weeks ago that made up that one sort of the RFP, or the initial stage of an RFP, to site some type of a neighborhood or community development on those 10 acres on this side of 40. So we are thoroughly engaged. I think the last year and a half, we've done a ton of pre-development work. We've selected a potential vendor. And now we're going through the steps of what would the roads look like? What are the utilities that would be necessary? How do we mitigate any traffic or transportation impacts? How do we make sure there's quality sidewalks and connectivity? And then what types of units and for whom? And those are all policy decisions that the mayor and council will make and deliberate and open in public sessions.
Yeah, but why rental housing here? I guess because, I mean, if they're going to be small, it seems like that's something that, again, people might be interested in actually owning something. I mean, of course, we've got all of that rental housing happening at HOPA, Aspen Villa, Engine House, Do we really need more rental housing?
Yeah, actually, thank you for asking that. I get this question a fair amount. I feel like there's the pendulum swings one way or the other, and the last project that we complete is sort of the, becomes the least desirable bucket that the community feels that we need to fill. So just bear with me. We did a lot of housing down here on Park Ave. There's a development we call the Skittles affectionately, or on the other side of the road, and it was deed restricted ownership housing. And basically, before we could open that project and hand the keys over to the property owners, people were saying, there's not enough rental housing in this community. You need to do more rental housing. And so then you complete a few projects of rental housing that, and you feel like the notion is, why are we doing rental housing? We should be only doing deed-restricted ownership. So just to take a step back, we are trying to fulfill many different needs at any given time, and we're contemplating multiple projects in this community. And so we hope to fulfill some rental need in this location. There are other locations where we're contemplating deed-restricted home ownership. But no matter what, we're trying to build a neighborhood. We're trying to add neighbors. And I don't think, from a municipal perspective, we are rating certain types of resident or certain types of ownership as less desirable, more desirable than others. I'm a renter, for example, and I don't think my neighborhood thinks I'm any more or less transient or better neighbor or less neighbor than the people living around me. And so there are going to be quality opportunities as we continue to grow and develop to bring different types of housing. But in that neighborhood in particular, of course, we're going to be very careful and deliberative to ensure nightly rentals are prohibited or things like that that really sort of creep into and can undermine a true neighborhood. And that is one of the healthiest neighborhoods that Park City has, is teachers, firefighters, nurses, doctors, lawyers. And so we're going to be really careful and deliberate about it.
And that's, I think, the letter writer's concern is like, yeah, we have created a great community out here. And transient rental housing does tend to be more transient.
And again, I just would counter, I believe we need it all at this point. I think there's such a dearth of housing, and you know, we have a relative housing crisis in our community, so we hope to continue spinning multiple plates at any given time. And I think there's an incredible opportunity here, and we've been talking about it for a long time.
Okay, Matt, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Leslie. I appreciate it.
That's Park City City Manager Matt Dias. The University of Utah ski team will be hosting the 2025 Utah Invitational, with alpine ski races taking place at the Olympic Mountain Center at the Utah Olympic Park. On the phone is head coach of the Utes, Justin Johnson. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so how big of a deal is this?
It's a pretty big deal. We're starting to have more events there at the Spencer F. Eccles Mountain Center, and this is about halfway through our collegiate season, so the qualifications for NCAAs are starting to build, and you know, the pressure is starting to get a little bit more for some. And I think the college level is so high now that the intake and the want to be in ski collegiately and have people see it has been really cool.
Yeah, so who's competing? Only collegiate athletes?
No, there'll be collegiate athletes, and then there's an open intense from like high-level athletes throughout the U.S., so people even from Park City Ski Team and throughout the whole U.S. and Canada and other nations, up to about 20 more spots after the colleges.
Yeah, so, I mean, if we were to look, I mean, are any of these athletes, I mean, are they U.S. Ski Team futures?
Yeah, so I would say out of the nine colleges in the West that are gone, we probably have 12 U.S. Ski Team athletes on the different colleges. I have a Canadian national athlete who just won a race over in Europe, a couple that ski World Cups from other countries. So it's about as high of a level as you get besides going over the World Cup.
Yeah. Okay. So tell us the schedule, days and times.
Okay. So we'll start out on Friday and Saturday with giant slalom races. Start time will probably be, it's not confirmed yet with this little warm weather, but probably 9:15-ish. We'll get going with girls and guys. Girls race first, followed by the guys. And that'll be the same for Saturday. And then Sunday as well, same time frame, but it'll be a slalom race. The viewing is very easy. You can drive up there. There'll be a big tent. You can see pretty much the whole hill from the finish line on the steep pitch. So it should be exciting.
Okay. And Friday actually doesn't count towards the NCAA scoring system?
Well, Friday does. Friday's just, we weren't able to go to, we have 12 qualifiers for the year, and we're only going to four schools this year, so a couple of them would just add as extra qualifiers. It doesn't count towards the University of Utah meet or invitational. So it still counts for the NCAA qualifying, but it's just sort of its own little makeup race, and then Saturday and Sunday will be the official University of Utah invitational.
Okay. So you guys are going to be on that big, steep course, yeah?
Yeah, that's correct. It's quite something.
Yeah. How steep is it?
That side over there, it's, you know, 20, 25 degrees on some parts, and it just sort of, you come off that top flat, and it rolls and rolls and rolls, so it just has this sensation where it keeps sort of rolling over. So it's quite actually awkward to ski and makes it very difficult, but it is a beautiful run.
All right. So how are the Utes doing? Seems like you guys are always into the top three.
Yeah, it's been good. I mean, we had that incredible run of winning the four in a row, and then last year just fell short by 2 points, which was quite the race there in competition. But doing well again. The level, you know, as of anything, like when we won those 4 years, obviously no one else wanted us to win anymore. And the level has just been so good. I mean, the other schools have really stepped up. CU and DU are very strong, have incredible teams, as well as Montana and a couple from the East. But you can just see the level rising and rising, and more people wanting to ski in collegiate sports. So it's pretty cool.
So those are the teams to beat then, CU and DU?
Yeah, CU and DU is pretty much, and yes, have been a little bit of separated from everyone else the last couple of years, and it's very, very tight. It's one of those things where out of those three, it's just whoever executes on that week in March, and it's going to be really exciting.
All right. I guess what do spectators need to know if they wanted to come up and watch the races?
It's pretty simple this year. So they can drive up the main big parking lot underneath the museum there. Will be open. And then it's a short 2-minute walk down. And there'll be food trucks and some other little amenities, as well as an announcer, scoreboard. So it should be fairly easy. We'll have a bunch of volunteers that will help with showing people where to go and what they need. And definitely on the weekend, the sun will be out, it looks like, and should be really exciting. So it should be fairly smooth. There's not a lot of security or anything. So people should be able to come up there for an hour, 2 hours or more, and just enjoy some ski racing at a very, very high level.
Okay. And I guess I just wanted to note, I see now that University of Colorado looks like they are in the lead, but you're separated by 23 points. So could the Utes, you know, take this?
I think so. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because we just came back from Montana, the Montana State last night, and we got that on the Alpine side by, I don't know, 40 or 50 points, and then the Nordics got it by probably another 60, so we really did well there. So we have a couple to make up here, but I think we got it. We're sort of starting to catch fire a little bit.
All right. JJ, anything else you want to tell us?
Not too much. I just love this town, like I always say, and I hope people come out and see it. And if you ever see any of us around, just come up and say hi. The Utes are very approachable, and that's about it. Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, thank you. That's Justin Johnson, again, Alpine Director of the University of Utah Ski Team. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Well, as the Wasatch County Council considers preserving two farms as open space, it's inviting the public to weigh in at its meeting tonight. KPCW's Grace Dorfler has details.
The Bear Tree Llama Farm and the Holmes Family Dairy Farm are both seeking open space funding from the County Council. Combined, the two properties are about 90 acres of land. The Wasatch Open Lands Board recommended the county give funding to both conservation easements at its meeting last month. Now the money is up for a vote. The county council is considering $750,000 of open space bond funds for the Pear Tree Llama Farm on 40 acres south of downtown Midway. It's also deciding whether to give $1 million in funding to the Holmes Farm, a 52-acre functioning dairy east of Heber. County Manager Dustin Graybaugh says he expects the county council will approve funding for both easements. Residents can share their thoughts at the meeting Wednesday starting at 6 p.m. Also at the meeting, Wasatch Open Lands Board President Heidi Franco will give an update on how the county has spent the $10 million open space bond voters approved in 2018, plus a $5 million bond the county council issued in 2020. The money has gone to 9 open space projects across 620 acres of land. Details about the open space bond funds and about how to attend Wednesday's county council meeting are available at kpcw.org. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.